Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. It can save you time and money so you provide your family with a financial safety net starting today. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius gives you unbiased advice from a licensed expert. They have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot from customers who have found the best fit for their needs. Policy Genius helps you compare your options from top companies and their teams of licensed experts. Talk to a team of award-winning agents who will walk you through the process step by step. Easily compare quotes from America's top insurers in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. Your work-life insurance policy might not be enough to protect your family's needs. Finding the right policy can be time-consuming and overwhelming. Let Policy Genius help you find the right policy and protect your family today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Do people want to be pilots?
No. I think it's definitely low right now, the desire to be a pilot. Yeah. The 10-year commitment for this generation is a lot to sign up for that long. That's the majority of hesitation
really?
For people that would be able to get there, right? Like,
okay.
They're just like, well, I don't want to sign my life away for 10 years if I don't even know if I'm going to like it.
Altitude.
Tower to my fixes, release you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire protect 2.
My program curveballs at 354.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted 6002 is still active.
What's up, and thanks for listening in. Hope everyone is doing well. My guest today is Mark Whistler, call sign Juice. He's a Viper driver. Started off his career in the C-130, actually in force support, so not even a pilot. And then ended up as a navigator in the C-130 and then made his way to the mighty Viper. Wrapped up his Viper time as a squadron commander out of Luke Air Force Base, and now he is an ROTC detachment commander over in North Carolina A&T. Had a fun time talking with Juice today. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. In fact, we had so much to talk about, we came back and recorded a second episode, which you can find out there, which we really kind of dig more into ROTC. And if you're not a person who's looking to go into ROTC or have someone that is, I think you'll still find that episode interesting, because we talk about some of the dynamics that are going on inside the military today and some of the things he's facing, which, again, when we talk generational, there's some unique pieces of today's environment that have changed just in 10, 20 years, let alone if you have been around for much longer than that. So that's the second episode. Again, it's more of an ROTC focus, but we hit on a few other topics there. Before you roll into the episode, just a few admin notes. As always, thank you to my Patreon supporters. Those looking for additional content or looking to support the show, you can swing over to patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. Also, you can find your way there via theafterburnpodcast.com. Again, for those of hard spelling like me. Over there, additional content. You get the There I Was stories. You get those much earlier than everyone else. Q&A sessions, some additional content. And if you just want to support the show, that helps me out. But at a minimum, as always, if you go to iTunes, Spotify, drop a rating review, help the podcast out if you're liking this content, help the show grow. And that's all I have. That's all the admin. Let's jump into the podcast with Juice. All right. I think now we're rolling. This should work now. The AT&T guy, I think, has buried the cable in front of my house. So that can't stop us. We've got the new microphone, so that's good to go. Again, people don't realize, Juice, just what goes into these podcasts. It's a small miracle every time, you know, what can go wrong. It all goes wrong. But for those listening, we had a few technical difficulties getting this rolling, but I got Lieutenant Colonel Mark Whistler, Juice, joining me on the podcast. So Juice, thanks for one, taking the time to join me, and two, you know, delaying like 30 minutes while I just sort my life out to try to make all this happen.
No, you're good. Thank you so much for having me, man. I've been listening to your podcast for a while, and a lot of my cadets listen to it. So this is kind of a cool, nice. I get to like brag to the cadets that I'm on this podcast, and they're like, oh, that's so awesome, sir. I can't believe it.
Nice.
So this is going to buy me a lot of street cred here at Jet 605.
That's awesome to hear, man. I'm glad to have you on here. Again, thanks for taking time. I know you're busy, although it's summertime. So I imagine the throttles crack back just a little bit. Do you get a little reprieve summertime?
It is. Yeah. The Fast and the Furious during the school year a little bit, but, during the summer, what I try and do is I try and cut most of the staff loose-ish. Yeah. So they do some, you know, working from home, working from the office. And then this summer, I've given each person one mental health day per week.
Nice. Okay.
To just let them go and do. I've told them it has to be some sort of like physical fitness or professional development or something with their family or something along those lines. They can't just be lounging around eating Doritos and watching football or whatever. Yeah. I need them actually working on themselves. So that's what we're doing this summer. So yeah, it is a little bit of a crackback, but we also have to send our staff to field training. And so we're min-manned each day. I'm trying to have two people in here each day to answer phones and answer questions and do the recruiting piece.
Do you have to do field training as a professor of aerospace studies? Do you have to go do that, or is that your...
You know, we do, but I didn't get called on last summer, and then I didn't get called this summer to go, so... My number I guess I was next on the list.
Yeah, better be lucky than good, right? I'm sure that's a lot of fun just for everyone involved to go to Maxwell, right? Which ironically enough, I was the first one to go through Maxwell. First forever or something like that.
I was a Lackland guy back in the day.
Yeah, I was super excited to call that first. that's good to hear though. The professional development, the mental health day, you're kind of giving people. This is some aspect, because you have a unique background, which we're going to dig into, but you just came from being an F-16 squadron commander to this job. I think I'm probably getting out of active duty about the time you're leaving that position. I think I've talked about it a good bit, but the fighter world as a whole, retention's not great. It hasn't been great. Trying to create more fighter pilots, trying to fill the gap. A lot of it's burnout. I mean, I remember, me included, a lot of buddies, you park it in AB and you leave it there and there's no reprieve. At home station, when you should be able to crack it back a little bit every now and then, you're going through upgrades, you're hot pitting, it's just never ending. And then, oh, by the way, surprise, you could go to red flag and then, hey, guess what? We're going to tag on 3 weeks of WIC support to that. Yeah. And then, you know, rinse, repeat. Oh, and then spin up, deploy. It gets to be a grinder. It's an awesome job, but it gets to be a grinder. So being able to crack that back. Fighter squadrons, I don't know did you see this with the contractors landing in the squadrons, like physical therapists landing in the squadrons, trying to take care of the fighter pilot, if you will, and trying to treat that as a weapon system in itself. Did you experience any of that?
Yeah. So Luke was on the leading edge of that, and it was pretty awesome to be a part of that push to like get us preemptive healthcare to take care of our bodies and do those things. And I'll just speak on my, you know, it was a retention tool that helped me for sure. Like I was on the verge of just being like, nope, I just want this to be done and over with. And that was one thing that it just, if it did anything, it kind of showed me that someone somewhere cared.
Yeah. Right. What? Yeah. And I think people like there are people who definitely care. And I saw like that stuff's on the chopping block already. And it sounded like a lot of people found out via Facebook, you know, a lot of commanders got skipped and went straight to Facebook, not the way you want it to do. Because I know there are people who legitimately care. It just seems with the bureaucracy, you are moving a ship, you know, with a rowboat at times, just trying to make things better. But all you can do is like those incremental things like you're doing right now, like kicking your staff out and making them go do something good for themselves once a week. That's huge, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Luke is one thing. Luke is a little bit of a break, right, from that grinder of the calf. And so to have that on top of it is definitely a place where people desired to go, especially we had, You know, when I was a squadron commander there, we had just the best leadership I've ever seen. An OG wing commander leadership team that just knocked it out of the park. And so that really helped, especially as a squadron commander. It helped just, you know, free up that space for us to do things, to create spaces for people to get well and do the things that they need to do with their families and stuff. So it was awesome to be part of that.
That's good, you know, and of course, the congressional.
Both of them are out of the Air Force,
right? You know,
unfortunately.
I'll say the squadron, the wing commander, and the OG I had at Shaw right before I left. Like those, if I could work for those two guys, hands down, the rest of my career, I would do that. There are threats out there that are not them that I did not want to work for, and I knew that, you know, as you move up the food chain, like it gets smaller and smaller, and you're going to work for people that potentially could have a very negative impact on your life, but really my concern was like my family's life, right? If I'm miserable, like they're going to be miserable, which was a big motivating factor for me to separate. But again, it's like there are, as you kind of talk about, like these two guys that you worked under, the two that I worked, Maestro and Hack. Hack retired. Maestro still, he has a star. He's moved on. But those guys, I mean, they're lightning rods. The spears they're absorbing on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I flew Maestro on a demo ride. And I remember it was right after he told Comac that Shaw was not going to fly our flying hours. My previous 4 years at Shaw, we were flying. It was nonstop. Like, talk about good problems to have. But like, I think in the month of July, I counted, I was like, I flew like 26 sorties. It's like, it's too much when you're doing mission planning, debriefing, mm-hmm. and you're not able to get the full quality out of it. But previous guys had always said yes, yes, yes. And I mean, it was breaking the jets. It was breaking the force just to get all the flying hours done. So you didn't turn to Congress and say, hey, we didn't use these. Oh, I know we were complaining we didn't get enough because of sequestration, but we can't use them. And he finally turned around and said, no, we're not doing it. And I was like, hey, boss, I realize how big of a thing that is that you said to the boss that we're not doing it. I think a lot of the guys will, maybe people will realize, squadron commanders for sure, DO is recognized, but like the lieutenant has like no idea the spear he just took right to the face for stepping up for something like that. But I don't know. Those guys, they're good and they're bad. I don't personally want to do that job. It's just a
kid. Our OG took spears for the, you know, the B course, you know, trying to slash B course, but ramp up production at the same time. Yeah. He was just, you know, he would publicly just go, no, that's not happening. Like, there is no way we can cut the B course to 5 months or 6 months. You know, there's no way to do that. So
I'm curious. Yeah. What did you see? The only thing I understand about UP, I've had stuff about UPT 2.5 on here. I'll be honest. I did an episode with Motor Riley, who I know Motor really well, and it was bad on me. I talked about a bunch of stuff. The one aspect I didn't realize is that they get their wings after T6s. So part of me is like, one, why is that? I can think that, you know, down the road, you're going to be able to cut the corner and get people, you know, to jets faster, maybe to heavies, or they're qualifying the T6, doing IFF T6, whatever it might be. But also I'm like, skeptical me. This is probably a numbers game. And look, we just like boosted the timeline by 6 months. And I saw a little bit at Shaw where they were talking about, they wanted to cut everything missionized out of the F-16 B course. Did you see, what kind of chops did you see them wanting to do out of there?
Well, yeah. So my experience in the B course is pretty limited because I spent the majority of my time, AKA all of my time at Luke, in the FMS world.
And that's so, right. I did see that. Good job.
I just sat across the table from the, you know, Mother Hubbard and those folks who were just like fighting the good fight every day, trying to figure out how to, you know, add rides back in and get those, the quality training for the students so that they weren't, you know, getting to the CAF and the CAF having to absorb all of that training that they weren't able to get them in the B course.
I remember, and you know, I did a thing on Mezzer's mishap with my buddy Bender, who was the chief of OGV at the time. And you know, to go through that, he was sitting there when the OG said, hey, we're getting these guys from the B course that have never been to the tanker. I don't know if you remember, like, I remember my first night tanking ride. I remember my first tanking ride. Like, all the penguins on the iceberg were just trying to hang on, and there's like, it was an ice cube and they were getting kicked off really fast. And yeah, it was a basic ride. It was going out doing like high aspect BFM, hit the tanker, but the focus was going to the tanker, and I mean, I was terrible at it. And then, you know,
yeah. And then you had night into that, and it just, I mean, it like,
what are we doing here? And so those cut, like in my mind, that's cutting corners, and that's a basic skill set that while it's not incredibly difficult, like you need to do it like once or twice where this is the focus to like, hey, all right, good. Now you can put your pants on. We can go to work type deal.
Yeah. I'll be honest. The time that I got good at tanking was when I had to, right? So like when you have to go across the pond, and if you don't get on the tanker, you don't stay on the tanker, you're going to have to turn around and go home, and everyone else is going to leave you. That teaches you real quick just to be an athlete and make it happen.
Right. That's it. There is no plan B, right? Like be a champion and like make it happen. I got three tanking events. I got, you know, one day, one night in the B course, and I showed up. And there was one random tanker and like MQT, and then there was like nothing. We went to Wessup out at Hill, and I was flying back. I got put in the D model, which was just awesome, you know, being like the new guy. But I had, I forget, Vaughn. I think he was a flight commander. He was in my pit. But he was like, man, you know, he's like, I don't know how to instruct you from back here. So I think that looks about right. He's never a B course instructor. And he's like, you know, if you don't make it happen, like, we're going to land and I'm going to get in the front seat. We're going home. I'm like, noted. Okay. Be a champion. You know, and it's like, you're going to make it happen.
Yep.
it's interesting to hear. I know we kind of digress, but I want to jump back a little bit and hear a little bit about like where you started, because you have had a slightly different path than most to get into the front seat of a Viper. Can you tell me about
that? Pretty crazy path. There's my phone. I meant to turn that down. All right.
He's a boss.
So ROTC graduate. I went to Montana State. I grew up in Montana. I have one brother, basically hunting and fishing all my life, and then playing sports. So sports was a huge aspect of my life. I go to college completely missing that aspect of like camaraderie and sports. And so I join ROTC. I follow my brother into ROTC and do that. About halfway through ROTC, we get the PAS swap out, right? So the professor of aerospace studies swaps out, and I get someone who is less than optimum for the job. and to be honest, now that I look back on it, it was definitely some maturity issues on my part too. But at the time, I was like, I can't stand this. Why am I in ROTC? Why am I going in the Air Force? And so I took the path of least resistance. And I'm like, just make me anything that I do 4 years and I'm going to get out and go back to Montana and be a teacher and a coach and life will be good. So I graduate as a services officer. We don't even have services anymore. Force support officer. And I go to Mountain Home Air Force Base. So I go one state over from Montana, and basically it's just like an extension of Montana. Luckily, my brother, who was also in the Air Force at the time and still is, he was a Strike Eagle Wizzo, and he was also stationed at Mountain Home. And so we got to reunite there, and I got to see firsthand like the ops side of the Air Force. And as a support guy, it opened my eyes, A, to what we were supporting, and then B, it was like, that's what I want to do, right? I don't want to be a support guy for the rest of my career. And so I followed him into that side, and I applied for the active duty rated board. From there, I got picked up to be a NAV. We don't have those anymore.
Old.
So I was a C-130 navigator. Yeah, old. Celestial, like shooting the stars type stuff. I was a C-130 slick navigator at Pope Air Force Base for one assignment, and then I got picked up to go to pilot training from there.
Oh, nice.
So in order to go to pilot training at that point in my life, I needed a waiver from the vice chief of staff because I had been in for more than 5 years, total active commission time. I don't know. It was, you know, all stars aligned, and I got that waiver approved and went to pilot training. From there, I went to the Viper, and the rest is kind of history. I did OSON Hill for a really long time, and then I went to school. And then I was for sure out of school. They're going to pull me to some staff because I'd never been to staff or anything. And I got pulled directly back to the Viper to be a DO and a commander out at Luke.
Yeah, better be lucky than good. That's kind of like the name of the game.
Luck and timing. It's just crazy because my brother, who's also an F-16 guy, way better officer than me, better leader. He, you know, he's done all the things in combat, like all the stuff in the Viper that I haven't had a chance to do, and didn't get to go to school, didn't get picked up to be a DO right away, didn't get picked up to be a commander. It only came like after everyone had written him off, and he was staff ATC staff A3, so he was like doing Stanoval stuff for ATC, you know, flying with all the different ATC units. He comes back to Luke as a sunset assignment and gets picked up as a DO and then gets picked up as a commander, and he's currently a sitting squadron commander at Luke, and he's 3 years older than me.
That's the thing, though. It's you know, right place, right time, right qualifications. That's how a lot of this stuff happens. Yeah. I mean, there's always anomalies, but I think that it's right timing. Like, that is a big factor of it. And honestly, you know, for me, that was actually a scary part. And one of the things when they were going around 2014 doing this fighter pilot, like, retention roadshow, I don't know if you were a part of that or not. But one of the aspects, I knew the 2-star personally, I guess it was like 2015, or no, it was later than that. And he asked, like, hey, what are your thoughts about staying in? You know, they gave this briefing. And unfortunately, we had a lieutenant colonel in our squadron at Shaw who showed up. He'd been out of the Viper for a little bit. You know, they put him back. They put him through the flug. And they're going to put him in the IPUG. But then they have a random 365 that's been vacant for 18 months. So they send him to Kabul. Works for the Army. So, you know, there's this whole, like, again, like, all right, it's a 12-month deployment. But, you know, he's got, like, 3 months of spin-up training beforehand. You know, the training doesn't necessarily align, so it really eats up, like, 5 months on the front end. And then on the back end, he's got R&R. And then they spend all this time figuring out if they're going to requal him at Shaw or if they're going to send him to a schoolhouse to requal him. Well, that takes, like, 3 months to, hey, we'll do an in-house requal at Shaw. And the wing commander's like, nope, we don't have enough hours for it. So this dude, he rides the last 3 years of his career out as, like, the op soup, you know, just sitting at the desk. You know, that was his one, like, primary, like, flying-related duty. And I was like, you know what? Like, the bad deal train show, the good deal train and the bad deal train, like, there are two trains. And if you get on the good deal train, like, life's usually great. But if the bad deal train shows up and you're the only one who can get on it, like, guess what? You have to go. Like, you could be a great dude, and it's going to be really painful for the rest of your time.
Yeah, and I think the Air Force is actually starting to realize that people other than the people on that bad train are paying attention to the bad train, right? Like, they're seeing the good dudes just get hammered by the bad train, and they're like, well, I don't want that, and they jump ship and go.
Yeah, because this guy was not a bad dude. He was a commander select of AETC and ACC, like, good dude, just, again, wrong place, wrong time. Like, he showed up, and, you know, he was, like, the last one to show up for whatever, you know, maybe he was finishing up his previous job, finishing up school, yada, 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 and he is just tailing Charlie, and it's like, well, we need an 05, and you're our least qualified F-16 05 at the time, so congratulations, you're going to Afghanistan, you know, it's like, man, so... That to me, and that was my reason. I was like, hey, look, you could be a really good dude and the stars don't align for you. And it could be a really painful, like, at that point you're on the bonus, like, you're going to get to 20 and it's done. Although now this is something you might know more about this. The fact that the 20 is gone, right? Like, the amount of young dudes in the squadron, when I was there, they all enrolled in the
blended retirement.
They had the option. They enrolled, but now everyone coming in is in the blended retirement system. So that 20-year carrot's no longer there.
Well, it is a little bit. So if you get to 20, you still get a percentage.
Do you? Okay.
It's just not as high. It's 40%, if I'm not mistaken. So they dropped it by 10%, but you have the ability to match now the whole time you're in. Well, the whole time minus the first 2 years. So you have to serve for 2 years, and then they start matching after that. So, gotcha. Yeah, I've learned more about the blended retirement system in this job than I ever wanted to know.
I'm curious because, again, that's something, one, it wasn't a factor for me. Like, I was going to hang out and be the 20-year. Like, that's doing the reserves. Like, the 20-year is the only thing that matters to me. Yep. But I know there were a lot of young dudes. Because I didn't think about getting out until about 2 years prior. Like, I didn't have my ATP or anything like that. And long story of why that showed up, but there was a person who showed up who was on the game plan that was really difficult to work with, that we knew he was going to be a superstar and not the guy you wanted to work for. But the amount of like young dudes in the squadron who like first assignment that already were like working on their airline app or like, you know, queuing everything up and their hours, I was like, oh, that's kind of surprising. Same, you know, they already switched to a blended retirement system, which told me that, you know, young guys, everyone is watching and they're aware. It's no longer, I think, just like, nah, we can bank on these guys staying in. And if we treat good guys good and bad guys will, you know, filter themselves out. I say bad guys. I mean, yeah, this is like, when we talk about who we're talking about, like bad's like, yeah, I don't know, you're in the top 5%, top 10% of whatever it is.
That that piece has become very clear to me about the caliber of people that are in the Air Force as I work in this job and just see kind of, because, you know, I have no military surrounding me here. And so it's just, it's us against the world. It feels like that some days. So it makes it very difficult, that decision to like jump ship. It has not become easier in this job. Because of that reason.
I'm curious about that aspect. I looked at going into business, and actually I do some things on the side that are non-flying related business-wise, good and bad, but it is like eye-opening. I mean, I think things that, not saying the military has this all dialed down, right? But I think inherently you get to this level, like you can show up on time to a meeting. If you're not going to make it on time, like you call ahead, you know, there's like these basic things that you would consider that don't necessarily happen or are not assumed in other places, which is surprising to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's just answering the phone or returning an email or those are the basic things that I'm missing right now from the military.
Meh, neither here nor there. Yeah. It's all good. All fun. Well, all right, back. Let's jump back into, the kind of transition out of the services world into being a navigator. One, you kind of glossed over it, I think, but I will hit on it. Like the fact that you got a vice chief of staff waiver to go to navigator training. I know that was no small feat. I don't even know how you'd write that ESSS nor how that'd be routed. That sounds incredibly painful, but you did it and you got approved. So obviously I imagine there were not a lot of people who got that waiver or get to that level.
Yeah, so that one, that was to get to pilot training. So that, because I had gone from services to nav, and then as I was deployed actually when the, you know, the results of the board came out, but they because I had been in for longer than 5 years as a commissioned officers, they would not allow you to switch AFSCs after 5 years. And so the waiver authority was the vice chief of staff. And so I, you know, there's a couple things that I think I did that set me up to get that, but it was not intentional, like, to get that waiver. I didn't even know that I needed it until I went to go put the UPT package in, and they were like, you can't do this. And you don't understand how many times I've been told no or been told you can't do this in the military, and I've just kind of fought back and said, no, there's got to be a waiver somewhere. I know that I can. There's a story. So when I was in the C-130, I was deployed a lot. I was stationed at Pope and I was only there for one assignment, but I think I slept in my house, my first house that I ever purchased. I think I slept in it probably like 36 to 38 days or something like that. And I was stationed there for over 2 years. So I was gone just a ton during that time. During my first deployment, the C-130 that we were flying was the E model, so the old Slicks, Pope. They are all in the boneyard now, or on sticks somewhere at Little Rock, or I think one of them's down at Pope still. We were deployed, and we had started trying to use this new, like, lack of a better word, like Link 16 for some bombers were on there, and then cargo. Okay. Airlift type aircraft. It was called the Combat Track 2 system. And we could, like, it was like a Merc chat almost. You could like text back and forth via your computer to different platforms that are in the AOR. Well, we got it put on our E models, and the E models, you couldn't use the air conditioner below 5,000 feet. And so as we were descending through 5,000 feet, you'd have to kill all the air conditioner, and it would just, I mean, the temperature would just skyrocket in there. And then we're like, you know, offloading cargo and unloading passengers in Iraq, and it was like 120 degrees, and everything is overheating. We're having to like shut everything down. Ugh. Well, we couldn't get anyone on this system because the way that they implemented the system was to cargo strap it down to the navigator bunk area, like, you know, the bunk in a C-130, and it has like that pleather pad that you're supposed to be able to sleep on that's really uncomfortable. Yeah. They just strap the thing down to that, and they're like, yeah, that should be good, it's not going to go anywhere. And I'm like, yeah, it's never going to work. And it would not, you could never get that thing logged in because it was overheated the moment you stepped to the airplane, and it never would cool off enough to get logged in. And so in my off days, we flew probably every other day of that deployment. But in my off days, I was, you know, besides working out, going to the gym, tan laundry, yeah, style, I walked around and I found like scraps of wood. And I took it to the wood shop on base, which we had a wood shop on base. We were at Ali As-Salim in Kuwait. Wow. And I built a box, if you will, out of the plywood that would allow to like rack these things separately and provide some sort of air to circulate around them. I took it to the OG and I was like, hey, can I take this on a C-130 and see if it works? And he's like, sure. So I take it in, put it all in there. Lo and behold, we get logged in very first sortie we use it, we're able to log in and it stays logged in the whole time. And so I come back and report it to the OG and he's like, I'm going to have CE build one of these for every single C-130 in the AOR. And awesome. So for months, I went home, and for months, actually it probably was years later, I was still getting text messages and pictures from the AOR of the box, like sitting in the C-130. They never came up with a better solution than a plywood box to put the combat track to.
That's amazing. You know,
so that right there is what I say got me the vice chief of staff waiver.
That's awesome. You know, the parallel story I have to that, because you probably used this at some point. I did MC-12s in Afghanistan, and then I deployed Operation Inherent Resolve before it was even named. And the 13th, the guys out of Massawa, like, they kind of kicked off combat operations, mm-hmm, there, but they were doing training. And then ISIS kicked it off. So the ATOs start flowing. And for those who don't know, like, the ATO, I mean, it's hundreds of pages. And I mean, there's a spaghetti chart of Excel numbers and things with all this data you need from, you know, IFF codes, so tanker tracks, tanker time, everything you need to go do a mission. And they were hand jamming all this stuff in. I mean, it was taking, to make one data card for one sortie, you know, it was taking like 2 hours. Like, per data card to like pull all this information. Undoubtedly stuff was going to be transposed incorrectly. So I was like, you know what? Like, I remember in the MC-12, we were using something. And so like, I reached back, it was actually an Alabama guard guy. Now he had it, this Excel doc that would extrapolate everything from the ATO, just a couple little tweaks. So like, I get it. And I'm like, hey, it's pretty exciting. I'm like, I have no idea how to make this work. It's all macros and stuff. We had one guy in our squadron, Chuck. He's still out there. Super geek. You're great, Chuck, if you're listening. But Chuck's like, oh yeah, I developed this when he was in the Viper. He got Tammy 21, like back in like 07. So like, he developed it like in 05 in Iraq. And this Excel doc like lived throughout all these conflicts, all these years. And it was like the best product that the Air Force could not come up with. They had someone else do it. It's like, how is this not a thing yet?
You're welcome, Microsoft, for that plug. Excel working from 2006 to... Right. I mean, I saw the same thing in the Herc. I deployed to the Kayak. I did a non-flying Kayak 6-month tour at Al Udeid. It was brutal. And we tried to transition out of, we were scheduling all C-130s for CENTCOM on an Excel document. And they tried to make us transition to, you know, like the PECs or wings or whatever it was. And it wouldn't work. And so I had like lieutenant colonels. I was a captain at the time. Yeah, I was a captain at the time that were like, you're no longer using that Excel spreadsheet. And I'd like pick up my monitor and be like, I am using it. See right here. Like, because the other thing doesn't work.
That's, yeah, it's like PAX. PAX, I just watch it from afar now, like the Facebook pages with PAX. It sounds like that's just a nightmare as a sunset certain features and some things don't work. You're like, hey, we're going to spend a lot of money on this product and like we're going to get it about halfway there. And this is how you're going to do everything now. So good luck. You're like, wait a minute.
Back to Excel.
Back to Excel, back to the puck board, you know, throw magnets, man.
Oh yeah.
Just good times. Therefore, it's great. It's all going to buff out in the end. It's just, this stuff is like comical. And while, I think here's the thing. Here's the learning point. There are some really innovative people and smart people out there, much smarter than me, such as yourself, who come up with great ideas to solve problems that shouldn't be a problem that needs to be solved. But correct. You know, yep. The fact that you're able to get that approved and fly with it is actually a testament to itself.
As a wooden box, it's not even like, it's such a fire hazard, but they're like, yes, load them on all the C-130s.
Yeah, we're using this special asbestos glue that's highly flammable and carcinogenic, but it's all we had over here in the Middle East to make these, but it's good. It's good. So there you go. Well, that makes sense then why you were able to get the vice chief of staff of the Air Force to sign off on you going to pilot training. Because what you mentioned is like you never take no for an answer. Like there's always, that's the thing. No matter where you go, someone like finance will tell you no. Well, like most likely that person really doesn't know the answer. They're just saying no because they don't want to look it up. Now, that's not always the case, right? So do it smartly, those listening. But your point is like there's usually always a way, there's always another way. There's a waiver for it, or there's another way to get whatever you're trying to accomplish, get done, that outside the box thinking. And there's a lot of parallels there between what you're saying. Yeah.
So I, you know, like I said, my brother is way smarter than me. He was Stan Avow at the time, and I was the DO of the 21st at Luke. And I don't know if it was weekly or biweekly, but I would call him and be like, how do I do this? Like, there's got to be a way to get from A to Z without having to go through every single. And he's like, I don't know how many times he said it to me, but he was like, well, who's the waiver authority? Did you like who, what regulation is saying this and who's the waiver authority for it? And it took about 6 months of me doing this where I'm like, all right, I need to question every regulation, everything that's in there and find the waiver authority and ask the questions, because there's people out there. And this was like in the age of when they were starting to push all that decision authority back down to the squadron. And so we were able to like do things that years they've been struggling with. And we're like, well, can we just get a waiver for it? And they're like, yeah, just waive it and move on.
I wonder if that's still going around. I did have one of my buddies, he sent me a message. He's up at Eielson. So, you know, the demo, the runway length and width was waived down. I think it was waived down to 75 feet for the Viper, but is in a demo regulation, which, you know, is not a F-16 Vol 3. So like, where does that, like who owns that, et cetera, et cetera. Cause they were running into issues at Eielson with snow and plowing the runway. It was a challenge to plow it all. You know, it was slowing them down. Like they're losing a go or whatever it was because of it. And I was like, I don't know, but that is part of the problem is there's so many regulations out there and so many different spots and who owns what and where does this fall? I think it's just been written over time and they haven't been cleaned out. But I felt like, again, there was a big push, and it felt like it lasted for about like 2 years, and maybe it's still going on. I'm so far removed now.
Where to get rid of AFIs? There was a huge push to get rid of AFIs, but what I see happened was they renamed a lot of them. And so they went from AFI to AFMANS, or, you know, like now it's a manual, not an instruction. They did get rid of a lot, and they combined a lot of stuff. So it has simplified it a little bit, but I just say the big lesson is read the first couple paragraphs of that thing every single time to figure out where the waiver authority lies so that you can read it with that bias and go, you know, how much risk do we want to assume here by waiving X, Y, or Z?
Do you feel as a ROTC commander, I mean, is that something you deal with regularly, or is it pretty cut and dry? Like, you know, students in the fall, students commission in the spring, like, are you running like,
There's not a ton of room for, you know, waiving things here, because it's pretty cut and dry what we do.
Yeah.
What, you know, the ones that I can think of are like, we have a blanket waiver right now from our region for the third go at the AFLQT, which is supposed to be at his level. He's waived it down to our level and just said, as long as they've done something between that second and third test, you can just go ahead and allow them to take that third test. Because, I don't even understand why, if they allow the third test on a waiver, like, just allow the third test. Like, what right. risk are we buying by just allowing right. a third go at the AFLQT? It's painful for everyone. So they're not trying to take it three times, you know?
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, that's really the only thing that I can think of that I've had to kind of go after a waiver for.
Is that for someone to actually pass the minimums or try to improve their score? And is that something you're seeing a lot of? Are you seeing, like,
yes.
Really?
Okay. I think it's intended to be for someone who cannot pass the test.
Okay.
I don't think it's written anywhere that it has to be used for that.
All right. So, follow on question, because I did a little bit of recruiting. I found it interesting that, I go back to the fighter pilot crisis, but I think you can tie it to the pilot crisis, if you will. And I guess we can't use crisis because that's solved. But they're,
Task force.
Yeah. So are you seeing, like, one, I saw where there are not a lot of people, or there are an overwhelming majority of people that are not interested in becoming pilots, which is fine. But I felt like when I was growing up, maybe I was just surrounded by a group of people that's what they really wanted to do. When I got to ROTC, you know, everyone in my class, with the exception of like one guy who wanted to go to med school, wanted to be pilots. And then, yeah, that carries through. We can talk about, you know, pilot training. No one wants to be a fighter pilot, et cetera. Are you finding it tough to, you know, have enough numbers in ROTC? Do people want to be pilots?
No, I think it's definitely low right now, the desire to be a pilot. Yeah. The 10-year commitment for this generation is a lot. To sign up for that long. That's the majority of hesitation
really?
For people that would be able to get there, right? Like
okay.
they're just like, well, I don't want to sign my life away for 10 years if I don't even know if I'm going to like it.
Interesting.
And so there's some of that. I don't know how much you know about the detachment that I'm at. So North Carolina A&T is the largest historically black college in the nation. And so, makes sense to put a guy like me here, right?
You fit the bill.
Yeah. It's been challenging. The first year was extremely challenging. Just, and I don't know how much, you know, predecessors before me worked at it. I know the guy that was right before me, he was a special operations guy. So he was a no-nonsense type and if you didn't know, then you didn't need to know type thing. He just, you know, he was cut and dry, very about just doing the job here and getting the cadets through and commissioning them. And he did good at cutting some of the fat that I think was being allowed to get through before that. But what we didn't have here was an established like relationship with the college. And so the college didn't understand us. And I showed up in the middle of A, the pandemic, and B, when I was traveling from Luke to here, it was in the thick of the George Floyd riots that were happening across the nation. And so, you know, I was driving here like eyes wide, like, are they even going to want me there?
Yeah.
You know? And come to find out, it works. It has been challenging, but after about a year, the people that I work with on this campus can see and can sense and hopefully can feel the fact that I am here for the good of their students. You know, like I really want everyone to get through this program and do the best that they can. And I don't think that's what they thought was happening before.
That's an interesting dynamic that I can't imagine being in. And this is one thing that, you know, probably not qualified to speak on, but the fact I know, like, racism that exists, right? Like, you're a white guy, right? And a predominantly, you know, African American, historically, you know, largest one in the nation, right? And there's not, again, the fighter pilot community is not very diverse I think that's one thing they're working on, right? But traditionally, you walk into a fighter squadron, it's a bunch of white dudes. Like, that is that is the fighter squadron. We had female fighter pilots. I go with, like, Loco, my good buddy, F-22 guy. He just took over squadron at Hickam.
Hawaii.
Yeah, and, like...
He was, you know, he's a graduate.
That's so, okay. Yeah, that's, I thought, I was like, Loco might... So, ironically enough, Loco is my first person I interviewed for this podcast, and it was so terrible... I was like, Loco, man, I cannot put this out. We're going to have to re-record it. Yeah, he just took over. I was trying to line up my schedule where I could go out there for his change of command, but I failed. So Loco is a great, great dude. And that is one thing that I know, again, racism exists. It's out there. But, you know, it's like I never have looked at Loco as a black fighter pilot. I've looked at Loco as a fighter pilot who happens to be black, like, because I don't care. And I think coming from, I don't know, at least – the fighter pilot world, like, I don't care what you look like, who you like, what you do, but I expect you to shoot the right person at the right time and, you know, drop the bomb in the right spot. Like, that's really, that's all that matters. Like, show up on time, be a good wingman, be a good flight lead, be a good instructor, whatever it might be. Like, that's all that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's been cool. And the fact that he's out there and I have connected with him, he came back for our dining out this year and he was our guest of honor, or guest speaker or whatever.
Okay. He was texting me, I guess, while he was out there. Now I'm all, I was in Alaska, and I was actually looking at raptors flying in the pattern, and I sent him a message. So I was like, okay, now all the stars align.
Yep. So we actually, started a podcast here. Our cadets started a podcast here, and they interviewed him when he was here. So
nice.
we've got an episode out there with him on it. Long story short, it has worked over the last 2 years, but it would work a lot better if they would put someone wearing this who is an African-American or who is, you know, a person of color, because the students here, it doesn't matter how much I tell them, hey, you can do this. You can, you have the ability. I know you can do this. They don't, it's their own like self-limiting and history basically up till like age 20, everything they've been through up to that point holds them back, and they self-limit themselves, if you will.
Yeah.
And basically say, well, the Air Force, they don't want me flying their planes. This is things that I've heard since I've been here. They don't want me flying their planes. And I'm like, no, they do. And I think you would make a good pilot. Like, push yourself and you can get there. And so I think if we were to put someone in this position wearing a bag, it would make the biggest difference for the Air Force. Right. Just to have that person who looks like them to represent them and say, look, I did it. You can do it also. And I think it would snap a lot quicker. Other things that we're doing in ROTC wide is because you talked about, you know, the desire to be a pilot. They've done this You Can Fly program where they get $3,500 and they hand it to me. And I just get to pick a student and go, hey, this student is doing well. Go to this FBO or pick an FBO in the local area and go use this $3,500 to go fly your first sortie and see what you think. And I've seen that kind of turn the light bulb on multiple occasions.
That's cool.
At this detachment, to where people were like, well, I want to do this. I want to do that. And I can see it in their eyes that that's not really what they want to do. They go fly and then they come back and they're like, hey, I want to be a pilot. And I'm like, I thought that's what it was, but I'm glad that this changed your mind.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's one thing I actually did. I was attached to Det 1 recruiting, which I got out and it was supposed to be dealing with like air shows and Lincoln recruiters and pandemic hit, like it all changed. But Det 1 is it's targeted at diversity recruiting, which I thought my strength there would be able to like, hey, you know, air shows, typically when you go to an air show, like it's not people from underserved communities. Like the inner city is not coming out to, you know, the countryside to the air show. But figuring out ways that, hey, you know, maybe this school that's underserved doesn't have recruiters, you know, show up, like you can get them and their families out there to do it. Long story short,
So that was my first introduction to the recruiting side, was because I did the demo thing 2013, 2014. Yeah. 2013 was completely axed, right? Like they hired me and then they canceled the whole season. And then they brought us back in like, halfway mode in just the heritage flight for 2014. And so I got to go to some air shows and do that. And we tried to hit, you know, underserved middle schools and high schools and stuff like that. And so you know, that was my first taste of like, they can't see themselves doing it. Yeah. They just like, it's just not in their brain yet to go like, I can do this. I can actually be a pilot.
Yeah. Cause like I say, I grew up in an aviation community. Like everyone around me, except for my parents, were pilots. They're Delta pilots. They're former Air Force or Navy guys. So like I was surrounded by it. So I could see that path. Like, I don't know. I didn't want to be a doctor or a lawyer. Maybe if I'd been surrounded by doctors or lawyers, that's what I'd want to do. Because yeah, if you can see someone who looks like you or you're exposed in that environment, that someone can like put the bumpers up and tell you to go this path, you can ping off the bumpers, but it gets you to the end state. That's huge. So I don't know. Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. And did you want to come, did you want to go do ROTC after Luke? I mean, to me, it seems like a sweet deal, but it's a different career path for most guys.
Yeah, my career path has not been standard like we talked about. And so, I was getting ready to wrap up my command. It was like a 2-year, 4 or 5 month command there. And I applied probably a year before to get picked up the summer that I would have been leaving.
Okay.
And I didn't make the cut. And so then I applied the next year and I'm like, I'll just stay a year at Luke after I graduate from squadron command and then try and go do the ROTC thing. And I didn't get picked up again. And I was like, what? Like, I have a master's in education, in adult education. I have a master's in education and I'm a graduated squadron commander. And they're screaming that they need pilots to be, you know, part of a sessions to bring in new pilots or whatever. And they would not pick me. So I actually called ATC and I was like, hey, they were going to have a supplemental board, but we had to completely reapply. And I called the guy that I was supposed to send all my information to. And I said, hey, I would love to reapply, but I need some feedback as to why I'm not getting picked up on these boards. And he looks at everything. And he's like, I don't see why you're not getting picked up. He's like, you should have gotten picked up. And I'm like, okay, thanks. That doesn't really help. So I fast forward about 2 weeks, this guy calls me and he goes, hey, do you still want to go be an ROTC instructor or a deck commander? I'm like, it depends. And he goes, well, we've got a couple open spots that are, you know, must fills and people fell out or whatever. And I'm like, whatever, I'm used to being the best of what's left. So go ahead and bring it on. And so he goes, hey, we want you to go to North Carolina A&T State University. And I was like, I don't even know. So I'm Googling it and it says Greensboro, North Carolina. And I turned to my wife and I'm like, didn't you grow up right near Greensboro? And she's from literally like 20 minutes from Greensboro. Her family all still lives here. And so we took this assignment for that reason so that we could get back close to her family and do what I wanted to do. You know, I circle all the way back to my ROTC days. I've always wanted to go back and be that first professor of aerospace studies that I had. He was a B-1 pilot and he was just an awesome dude.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go back and do that. And so this was my chance to do that. And honestly, I see a ton of like impact that you can have as a PAS on the students that are just leaving this system and heading out 100%. Into the Air Force, just doing things right. Little things like doing commissioning right, where we have, you know, whoever you want to commission you can come. I don't care how long the ceremony lasts. Like we can do this all day. If you want to have your grandfather come in here and we have to walk him down to the stage for him to raise your right hand and give you the oath, that's the way we're going to do it. And just those little things of taking care of people, I've seen start to impact the culture of the cadets here. And they're actually starting to like get it.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
Hopefully that's the way it continues after I leave here. And who knows, you know, the way of the military, you leave and you never really know what's going to happen with your squadron, but you wish it best and walk out the door.
Yeah, it's good and bad. I'll be honest, Juice, the only thing I heard in that entire time was the luckiest man on earth, how he didn't become the deputy OG at Holloman or Kunsan. The fact that you're able to hang around Luke for a year or so after.
Yeah, so it was in the middle of the crisis, right? And so they were handing out second assignment in place.
That's awesome.
And it was not, I don't think it was a program meant for squadron commanders, but again, the leadership that I had from the OG and wing commander, I was like, well, I'll apply for that. And I applied for a second assignment place and they approved it. And it went to ATC and they're like, I don't think it's whatever, approve it.
So this is the wrong guy signed. Oh, I didn't mean to sign that form, but it's signed now. So I'm here.
Yeah. So man. I had a second assignment in place. I was just going to be there for another 3 years after I graduated squadron command. But then this derailed that. So,
yeah, the 05 just flying the line in the Viper at Luke sounds it like it might be the best job in the world. But
it,
I'm sure that
it was. And you know, I have no qualms with people who did it. As I got closer to graduating squadron command and was dealing with some of that leadership stuff, I was like, I don't think I want to be that guy. You know?
But,
there was just part of me that was like frustrated with the way that they were gaming the system a little bit. And, you know, they wouldn't fill the schedule on these days and I can't fly that sortie because it's too much mission planning and too much debriefing, but I can fly the sortie because I can walk in, fly it and walk out and, you know, have a 4 hour day.
Yeah.
So part of me was a little bit frustrated at that. And so I jumped at the chance to be like, I don't want to do that. I want to go do something that has a little bit more impact.
The doing the ROTC bit, one, I always thought would be really interesting, but like you said, I know the impact you're having there. It's got to be huge. It's good to, I mean, ROTC needs good officers to come back. Like that's the first, like that's where the shaping, the molding is really happening, I think. And obviously it happens once they commission and move on. But I do remember I had a really good set of cadre for like 3 years. And then my last year, a guy came in who was just like the epitome of, I was like, I don't want to be anything like this guy.
Like, it's the non-example, right? Like, I'm never going to do that.
And that's, it was immature at the point. Like, there's always a way to like kind of work with it, but I was like taking notes. And later on, like I had a lot of good bosses. I mean, there's really only one squadron commander that just wasn't a huge fan of. And the joke was like, we're just taking all these lessons learned and just throwing them in the don't ever do this file, you know? I mean, like,
as long as you're learning, it doesn't really matter, right?
Right.
You can learn good and bad.
It's just painful. Every day is really, really painful. And I just have to keep filing away. I need to get a second filing cabinet, but no, it's good to have that. And that's, you know, for pilot training, that's another factor, I think too, when it kind of builds on to getting people to want to be fighter pilots, especially in the T6 world, there's just not a lot of guys who are fighter pilots flowing back. I think it's slowly trickling, but
slowly
it might be a dude in a squadron now who is from a previous fighter.
Yeah. On the ROTC side, I think we'll see the quality get better because they've started that OIRSD process. It's basically a competitive board for recruiting. And so you have to put your name in and it gets boarded. Now, my trust in that system after I tried 2 years in a row to get through that board and not get selected was a little shaken, but I've seen it evolve over the last couple of years. And I think we're getting better at it. And I think we're picking the right people now.
I now really think of it as like, how did you not get picked? You know, that's, and so now everyone applies. If they want to be an ROTC instructor, they apply to that. And then in theory, they get filtered and matched.
Including deck commanders.
Really?
So you have to apply to a board and then you make a list. And then the region, so there's four regions and the region commander has to hire you off that list. Just like a Hawk board or whatever.
I was going to ask, is it, if you're on the Hawk board and there's listening, like that's a, you have to, that's the Air Education Training Command board that meets to select who will be eligible to be squadron commanders in AETC. So obviously you were an AETC, you know, squadron commander, but is that's a separate process to this?
It is. Yeah. You have to be on the Hawk board also to be a deck commander.
Okay. Yeah. Why not make them do both?
Make it more painful. Yeah.
Cause I mean, I assume that's air. You're somewhere under Air University, right?
Correct.
Which is under AETC. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, everyone's got to have their little kingdoms. So you can't give those up.
Yeah.
That's interesting. But again, that doesn't give me a whole lot of confidence. Hopefully, like you said, maybe the system's getting a little bit better because I would imagine you had the qualifications to be there the first time around after, you know,
I thought having I did. Been
a sitting fighter squadron commander in AETC. But
I thought maybe it was like the functional not wanting to release.
Yeah.
But we, like the OG went to the functional and was like, hey, is it because you're not saying that he's good to go, and they're like, no, we'll let him go.
Yeah, I would figure that would stop even before, like, the functional would, like, you wouldn't even be able, I would imagine they're, like, one of the initial signatures to allow your package, so to speak, to go to the board. So yeah,
no, it's weird. It's after the fact. So if you make that board, they have to sign off on it.
Classic.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, well. All right. We jumped around a lot with ROTC and stuff. I want to ask a few more questions about maybe some of the nitty gritty C-130 and F-16 stuff. But the fact that, again, that you were able to, you know, jerry rig and make up your own C-130 equipment and get it approved and flown in theater is pretty awesome. But you, get picked up for pilot training out of that, get the Viper first assignment, and then you go Kunsan or Hill first?
I went to Osan first. I was Osan.
Okay. And then Hill, and then as far as I saw, you did a TSP, right, to Kunsan?
Yeah, I did a TSP to Kunsan. Were you there?
No. I was looking at your bio. I was like, TSP. Yeah. But that's like the Shaw deal. The shooters always went TSP. Gamblers and the Tigers always deployed. But, you know, guys would go Kunsan, PCS to Shaw, be a shooter, then TSP, Kunsan, come back another 6 months or so, and then go PCS to Kunsan.
Yeah, I did the Osan for 18 months to Hill, and then 10 months later, I was back at Kunsan for 7 months.
Yeah, nailing it. Yep. And it's just like a vicious cycle. I always like call it the triangle of death now with Shaw, Kunsan, Holloman. You know, you're just getting like this vicious cycle.
Yep.
But, you know, first world problems. Then throughout that, too, like, you're kind of late to the game getting to the Viper as far as career goes.
Yeah,
was it a challenge for you to, you know, deal with upgrades, get the jobs that you need to do to, you know, get promoted and things like that? Or how did that work out for
you? Yeah, so for my first assignment at Osan, I showed up and my squadron commander randomly was a prior C-130 navigator turned Viper guy. And so he immediately like glommed on and was like, hey, we need to give him a position in the squadron that looks good on paper, right? So like he needs to be the chief of something immediately, even though he's a wingman. And so I became the chief of scheduling standard first assignment. It was brutal at Osan. Fighting good for airspace you. Until midnight every night. But that, you know, that position right there, I think I performed decent at it. And that kind of just begun the snowball for me to be able to upgrade faster, right? People pushed me through upgrades a little bit quicker. I had, you know, Hulk Bennett.
I do. Yeah. Hulk, he actually took over the Gamblers right as I was separating. Yeah.
Yeah. So Hulk was, just a line IP at the time. I think he was maybe a flight commander, but he went to WIC from Osan. Okay. And he pushed me hard, made me study all the time. I mean, he was like on me to like get it done because I think he could see that like I was behind in the jet, but my leadership or maturity outside as an officer was, you know, where it needed to be. And so he was pretty hard on me. Kata Arki was another one that pushed me pretty hard during that time. And so, you know, I had mentors along the way and they're like peers to me now. But at the time I showed up and, you know, Hulk was an IP with 900 hours and I was like this peon wingman that didn't know anything about the F-16, but we were the same year group basically.
Yeah.
So it was just an interesting dynamic, and I had kind of dealt with it through pilot training to kind of walk that fine line because I was older than my flight commander at pilot training. And so I think going through pilot training and having that relationship with the flight commander where he understood where I was a lot older than everyone else, but he still held me the same, you know, he's held me accountable as anyone else, helped me when I got to Osan to kind of know that fine line and how to walk it. I became a flight lead at Osan. On my very last sortie was my FLUG cert.
Nice.
So I did my FLUG cert, Finney flight. They, you know, whatever, taped me up to the pylon and sent me on my way.
Yeah, can't do that now.
Can't do that anymore. Yeah. No duct tape, no water, whatever the regulations say.
Too harsh. Yeah.
And then from there, I went to Hill, and it kind of just stayed the same kind of mentality. Like, I was working pretty hard. But people were there taking care of me too. And so, my squadron commander pushed me right when I got there and I became an ADO, I went through the IPUG shortly after getting to Hill.
Yeah.
And so they pushed me really quick through there. And then I was an instructor for like 2 years. And then the demo gig kind of evolved and I became chief of standby at Hill while I was doing the demo gig, working for the OG.
So you're doing both, because
yeah,
I did demo.
And that was the thing, like, because it wasn't a full up demo, they just kept me as an instructor, as an evaluator. I was an evaluator and the demo guy, and which was cool for me. I got to do, you know, not upgrade rides, but I could do kind of plus rides for people.
Yeah.
Out and back, I could have them lead the sortie out and back to wherever we were going. I could come up with objectives to like check stuff off in their grade book to actually get stuff accomplished on our sorties to and from the air shows. So that was kind of cool. And at the time, no one was going cross country. Like, no one had ever used their radar to paint thunderstorms or do any of that. And so we got to do some of that old school stuff on the way. And really the mission planning piece, I think, really helped a lot of the wingmen, trying to like cold calling tanker units and be like, hey, do you have a training sortie that you can just meet us at this tanker track with this much fuel so that we can make it in one hop versus having to like three hop it over there? So yeah, that part was kind of cool.
No, that's awesome. I mean, for those who are not catching on that time frame, sequestration, so, you know, or coming out of sequestration, everything ground to a halt, and yeah, demo teams went away, and then like you said, came back as a heritage, or you guys, was it just shut down at that? It was just heritage.
Just heritage. We completely shut down. So I was in the unit at Hill that completely shut down. We did not turn a wheel for 103 days. Or maybe it was even more than that. I think it was like four months that we did not even start, or we would go start the jets and run the engine and then shut it down. And we were doing BSA crazy? In the sim. Oh yeah.
That's just nailing it, which I did see an article, the flying hours, they just got cut. So, you know, it's a cycle. What can you do?
It is. Yep. And from there I went to school. And then out of there, I went to Luke to be a DO and a commander. I thought for sure with my weird timeline, you know, I hadn't been in the F-16 as long as everyone else. I thought for sure I would go to staff or do something before I would come back to the jet, but they pulled me directly back to the jet. And I think it's just a direct correlation to how many people were leaving the Air Force in my year group at that time.
Shaw, I felt like I saw a lot of guys kind of similar. They would go to school and then come straight back, or they would go be a DO and Kunsan and then straight back to Shaw.
Yep.
I'd be curious to see how it plays out. I know my year group, in this road show, I think they said there was like 16 of us in our year group for the Viper. And I don't know if that number is like normally like 80 or so, but like they knew there wouldn't even be enough of us if we all stayed in to be squadron commanders, let alone be O6s. And then I think out of that group, like there's only two that are still active duty. So there's one guy I graduated pilot training with, and it's kind of interesting. I saw he took over a squadron last year, but then like my weapons officer when I was in the Gamblers, who was older, like he just took over a squadron. Again, I think a fast track guy, but it's interesting to see where the puzzle pieces align and where guys land and what's open and what's not. But
yeah, best of what's left, like I said.
Well, Juice, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat today. Before we split, I always like to ask everyone, if they found, 15, 16, 17-year-old Juice walking the streets, is there any advice you would give him? Anything you'd say, hey, do this different, or hey, go check this out?
Yeah. I mean, like we talked about earlier, I would definitely give them the advice to not take no for an answer. And the other piece is not think that they know everything, right? Because when I was that age, I thought that I knew everything and I knew exactly what I was going to do with my life. But just having like an open mind and allowing, good people to influence me in a positive manner, i.e. my brother when I was at Mountain Home, to be able to show me the ops side, I think has definitely changed my vector when it came to where I was going to end up. And so don't take no for an answer. There's always a waiver, right? And then be open-minded to changing your game plan if you think you know everything, you don't.
Perfect advice. Juice, thanks for joining me, man. I really appreciate talking.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to the podcast today. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, if you're enjoying this content, do me a favor, swing over to iTunes, Spotify, drop a rating or review. That helps the podcast out. If you're looking for additional content, again, swing over to patreon.com/theAfterburn Podcast. You'll find more great stuff living over there, and then you help the podcast out.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETIDE.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETIDE.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.